My guest is Timothy Ferris. He teaches science writing and astronomy at the University of California at Berkeley. Public television viewers may remember him as the narrator of the award-winning special Creation of the Universe, which he also wrote. His articles and reviews have appeared in Esquire, The New York Times, and Rolling Stone, to name but a few. He's received the American Institute of Physics Prize, as well as a Guggenheim Fellowship. His best-selling book, Red Limit, received the American Association for the Advancement of Science Writing Award. He has a new book, and it's called Coming of Age in the Milky Way. Timothy Ferris, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Good.
Well, we have a real task in front of us. We have to talk about the history of the universe in about 30 minutes, and you managed to keep the history of the universe down to under 500 pages. That's a task of rather Herculean proportion, isn't it?
Well, we know so little about it. I've tried to specialize in things that, which we're almost entirely ignorant, and that way it's possible to become an expert in them.
So what do you mean? By doing little bits of the history of the universe, you kind of get an overview of the whole thing?
No, it's just that the totality of what we know about the history of the universe is so little compared to the reality, and always will be, that the best that we have been able to get, and ever will really get, is going to be just a glimpse through the keyhole. But it's quite exciting what you see even in that small glimpse.
It's our universe that we're talking about, though. It's not the universe as a whole, is it?
Well, the astronomers use a term they call the observable universe, which for technical reasons is more time-limited than space-limited. But there's plenty within it. The radius of the observable universe is something on the order of 10 or 20 billion light years, and you've got somewhere around 100 billion galaxies with roughly 100 billion stars each in that area. So it, even if you consider that but a small portion of the total universe, which it may be, it's still plenty for everybody.
It took you 12 years to write this book. What was the hard part, sort of your mandate as a journalist, to get the facts straight and then try and communicate them?
that's pretty much it. I got interested in astronomy when I was just a little boy, and you know, when you have these childhood interests that you're lucky enough to be able to pursue as an adult, at some point you want to know about the history of the field, and so I undertook to write a book that would be a history of the concepts of the universe that we've had and our exploration of the world around us, and it was a wonderful process, but it turned out to be a lot more work than I would have thought.
Was part of the work finding the metaphor to kind of explain the mathematics?
Well, that's always part of it. You know, Robert Frost said that all metaphors are imperfect, and that's the beauty of them. And what you want to try to find is a metaphor that's imperfect in some defensible way, that's true to the spirit and the fact of what you're talking about, and yet blooms in some way in the reader's mind. And that is a lot of the part of it. And a lot of it is just, you know, pouring through thousands of books and the lives of hundreds of people and trying to figure out what the hell was going on.
You write, at about the time you're writing about the 18th century, that apparently journalism did have one contribution to science, and that's when the philosopher Immanuel Kant misread something, right?
There was a man in England named Thomas Wright, who was a sort of a religious ecstatic, interested in cosmology, the science of the structure of the universe. And Wright used to come up with different theories about the universe and publish them every 6 or 8 weeks or so, and many of them mutually inconsistent, but all accruing to God's greater glory and so forth. And one of these books was reviewed in a Hamburg journal by a critic who got it wrong. And Immanuel Kant read the review and got the wrong impression of what Wright had said, but as it happened, the journalist's error turned out to be correct. What the journalist said was the first intimation of the actual structure of the Milky Way galaxy, and Kant immediately saw a connection between that and what the astronomers were seeing in the sky and produced the first theory of the existence of galaxies. If it hadn't been for that journalist, we might have had to wait another century.
That's a marriage that's been going on for quite a while, isn't it? That marriage of philosophy and astronomy.
Yes, you know, scientists today mostly don't like to talk much about philosophy. And philosophy, there's a good reason for that. Philosophy has lagged considerably behind physics and mathematics in the 20th century. But in the long run, you can't get away from it. You know, philosophy is like what Bob Dylan said about love. It doesn't matter what you think about it, you just can't live without it. It's, you're going to have to go back to philosophical issues sooner or later. And I've tried to keep investigating those, even though it's not always popular with the scientists, and sometimes not even with the philosophers.
Well, even science itself, there were the scientists that observed and did experiments, and then there were other scientists that just, I guess, sat around and thought about it.
Yes, the sit around and think about it ones are call themselves theorists, and they're not, you know, so sedentary as their image suggests. Einstein, for instance, was widely regarded as the greatest theorist, perhaps of all time. Started out as quite an experimenter. In fact, he badly injured his hand when he was an undergraduate in an explosion in a lab while doing an experiment. And, he loved to tinker. And I find that, particularly among physicists, even the theorists usually have a skeleton in their closet in the form of a childhood attraction to tinkering and breaking things up and seeing how, trying to put them back together and so on. But in adult life, there is a sharp division between the experimenters who are in there in the guts of the particle accelerator actually pulling things apart and the theorists who work more in the abstract.
Mm. Einstein himself was really a fascinating character. That's one of the things I really like about your book is the way that you kind of illuminate these people's lives. And there's a story that you tell in the book that illustrates the tenacity of some of these scientists, Einstein in particular. It's the paperclip story. Could you relate that story to us?
Einstein was working at Princeton with an associate of his named Ernst Strauss. And they finished writing a paper together one afternoon, and they were looking for a paperclip to clip it together, and they looked through all the drawers and couldn't find any, and Einstein suggested that they look for something they could make a paperclip out of, and they kept looking, and finally Einstein found in a corner of a file cabinet a paperclip, and he unbent it into a straight piece of wire and then started bending it again to make a paperclip out of it, and Strauss looked at him and said, "What are you doing?" And Einstein realized what he was doing and said, "Well, I suppose this tells something about myself, that once I'm set upon a task, I can't be dissuaded from."
Fascinating story. Was there an era that particularly fascinated you as you were starting to write this book?
Well, the Greeks, of course, always haunt every history like this. You can't escape a fascination with the age of Plato and Aristotle. That lamp is just never going to be extinguished as long as there are people on this planet. And the 20th century, of course, in science overshadows all the others because so much has happened in the 20th century. So there tends to be these histories tend to open very strong and close very strong.
Mm. My guest is Timothy Farris. His book is Coming of Age in the Milky Way. Let's talk a little bit about ancient theories of the universe. There's a story that you heard when you were 9 years old about Hamlet's mill.
Mm. There's an ancient Scandinavian myth that says that the Earth, as it turns on its axis, wobbles, and that the reason it does so is that there was once a great mill responsible for turning the Earth, and it was being transported by sea, and the ship sank, and the mill sank to the bottom of the sea. And because it was in the wrong place, it made the Earth wobble. And this is a fascinating story because the axis of the Earth does wobble. It's called the precession of the equinoxes, the result of it. And this was known to the ancient Greeks, but the knowledge was thought to have been lost in the Middle Ages, and yet here it seems to turn up in this old myth. In any case, when I was 9, I was in a rural school where I was going to school in Florida, and the kids were talking one day in the playground about why the sea is salty, and someone asked me why, and I started to give some sort of pontifical little answer.
When you were 9, right?
Yeah, I was insufferable even then, but you know, the salts are going down to the sea and so forth from the mountains. And a little girl said, "No, that's wrong. The reason the sea is salty is that there was a great salt grinder on a ship, and the ship sank, and it kept grinding on ever since as the earth turned, and it made the sea salty." And that's that same story.
Isn't that interesting? In your brief history of important events in the universe, which is about 4 pages at the back of your book,
yeah, I was brief with a vengeance.
Well, yeah, but what did you say? Economy is a jealous god. Is that your?
Yes, that's true.
So you're bound to be criticized. But I was fascinated when I learned that when man first became upright and began to walk, the constellations had not yet formed. So the sky that the ancient man was seeing is not the sky that we're seeing today.
That's right. You know, the sky is, the stars are all moving across the sky at the, following their own paths. And what we see as the constellations is like a snapshot taken of, say, people in Grand Central Station at rush hour. At that moment, there's a given pattern. But as years go by, and it only takes a matter of thousands to tens of thousands of years for this to happen, the stars will continue to move so that the constellations as we know them will all be scrambled, and people will have to invent their own, as they doubtless will if they're around.
As the ancient civilizations that coexisted were taking a look at the sky, say, for lack of better example, the Mayans, the Sumerians, the Chinese, were they all coming to similar conclusions?
There are some similarities, some of which may just be what the biologists call convergence, where you have a good idea and it's arrived at independently, or a bad idea sometimes. And others appear to have resulted from actual communication between people. You know, there does seem to have been quite a lot of inter-societal communication before the start of recorded history. And a lot of ideas got handed around. So that the Big Dipper, for instance, although some people call it a plow, was a Big Dipper in China and in Europe many years ago. And that may be because it looks like a dipper, or it may be that they, so at some point someone got together and they said, well, we think of it as the shaving instrument, you know. And they said, no, it really looks more like a dipper. And they said, oh, you're right.
So. Oh. Can you understand, because of man's relationship to the universe, during the ancient days, man thought the universe was very close. The stars were, you know, you could almost, if you got to a high enough point, you could touch the stars, touch the sky. Where this belief in astrology has come from?
Well, in my view, the belief in astrology expresses a deep and, I think, mysterious longing to find connections between ourselves and the stars. And there really are a lot of such connections, even if the ones averred by astrology aren't among them. We're finding now much more intimate connections between ourselves and the wider universe than I think anyone a century ago would have anticipated. The Earth, after all, formed out of the same cloud of material as the Sun did and the other stars have. Our chemical composition is very much like that of the universe at large. The atoms in our bodies were once parts of stars. Particles from space passing through our bodies are affecting us in various ways as we sit here and talk. It really is all one great weave. And we're part of it, and we're just beginning to realize that the apartness that we felt from the wider universe was largely a myth.
The apartness that we felt was we are all part of it.
We really are. It's an old mystical assertion, but when you look at it scientifically, you really arrive at the same conclusion. You can point to gross effects like the fact that the Earth may be due to be bombarded by comets in 10 million years, resulting in mass extinctions, including perhaps our own, if we're lucky enough to make it for another 10 million years. But there are also many subtle effects that are just beginning to be understood. There's no wall, in other words, between us and our planet, and there's no wall between our planet and the rest of the universe. It's all of one piece.
My guest is Timothy Ferris. His new book is called Coming of Age in the Milky Way. And I'd like to ask you about some of these little subtleties that we're discovering between ourselves and the universe after we take just a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Timothy Ferris. He teaches astronomy and writes extensively about science. His new book, Coming of Age in the Milky Way, charts the history of man's relationship to the universe, and that relationship is a lot more intimate than perhaps we thought before. What are those subtleties you were talking about? Can you give examples?
Well, one example are subatomic particles coming down through space. Millions of them are passing through us each second as we sit here and talk, and some of them strike cells in our bodies and create damage. And there are probably on the order of several tens of thousands of cells in your body and mine right now in which the little working agents are busy repairing damage caused by these collisions. Some of those collisions damage genetic material, and some of them, in those cases, create mutations. And some of those mutations are passed along to our offspring, and they affect the course of evolution. It's not the main mechanism, but it is one mechanism that contributes, therefore, to the variation of individuals and the species and to the course of human evolution. Now, I've often wondered, once we know this better and understand it better, a century or two down the line, if we may not be able to see literally in the faces of people or in the fleck of gold in an eye or in the pattern of a dorsal fin of a fish, some random element that has literally come down from the stars.
I'm speculating now, given what you've just said, about what theologists are going to think about this, because science and theology, again, is another marriage that's gone on through time, isn't it?
It really is. It's often said that there's a dispute between science and religion. I don't think that's true. I do think that there is a dispute between people who feel that they already know everything that they need to know and people who have a sense that there's something yet to be learned. And you can find pedantic, lead-headed, self-satisfied people in theology as in religion. I mean, as in science. and you can also find people who view life as an open-ended adventure in both those fields. And between those people, there is a real alliance. I don't think that it's fair to say, as some people do in the churches, that the scientists labor up one side of the mountain, and when they come to the top, they find the theologians already sitting there. I heard this remark made just the other day on a Christian television broadcast. I think that's wholly mistaken. A career in science is not spent arriving at the same, working hard just to arrive at the same conclusions that someone has already written down in a holy book. But the underlying desire to understand the wider reality and to invest life with an intellectual and moral worth greater than has been given to us already is shared by good people in both these fields and in art, for that matter, and many other fields as well.
And thinking about what you've just said, it brings to mind a man who you talk about in your book, Galileo, who I don't know, from reading this book, turns out to be not such a nice guy, you know?
He was not such a nice guy. No. He was a great man, but he was not a nice man. Mm. Einstein was both great and nice. Newton was great, but not nice. You know, you don't have to be nice to be a certified genius, and Galileo wasn't. He was quite a self-seeking, self-promoting guy. It wasn't entirely his fault. He had real financial problems, for instance, that he needed to overcome, and he did so by writing a best-selling book, and he had to cut some corners along the way.
Yeah, like claiming he invented the telescope,
Yes, he did, that was not one of his grander moments.
Now, did he drop the cannonball and the bocce ball from the Leaning Tower of Pisa?
Almost certainly not. It's one of those wonderful pictures, and one of those stories like Columbus was out to prove the world was round, you know, which is another myth. The problem with, you know, obviously, if you could take a cannonball and a little bocce ball up to the top of a tower and drop them and they both hit the ground at the same time, someone would have done that a long time ago, and and Galileo wouldn't have had to go to all the trouble of doing the experiments he did to determine that objects all do fall at the same velocity regardless of their weight. The problem is that air resistance interferes in that. That's why a penny thrown off the top of the Empire State Building will not make a crater 3 feet deep in the sidewalk, as we were told when we were school children. Air resistance makes a big difference, so the experiment wouldn't work. Someone did drop two balls off the Leaning Tower, it appears, but it appears to have been a successor to Galileo who disagreed with him and was trying to show he was wrong.
Another person who was working at the same time was Johannes Kepler, who seemed to be the total antithesis of Galileo. I mean, this guy, everyone thought he looked like a slob, right? And he had no instruments at all, and yet he was a brilliant man.
He was a wonderful man. He was the greatest astronomer of his time. And he was one of Galileo's great supporters. When Galileo wrote his little book saying, "This is what I've seen through the telescope," a great question that was raised was, are we to believe this book? No one else has any telescopes. And even if you look through them and you see these things, how do you know that what you're seeing is real as opposed to being an illusion, such as you would see through a kaleidoscope? And Kepler put his reputation on the line by saying, "I believe that these observations are accurate and that Galileo's word is to be trusted and that this is a great moment in astronomy." Kepler then wrote to Galileo asking if he could borrow a telescope so that he could himself make these observations, and Galileo wouldn't send him one. He was too busy currying favor with the nobility. So it's, I'm afraid, you know, as people of moral character, Kepler comes off better than Galileo.
Isaac Newton was born the day that Galileo died, which is kind of interesting. This Isaac Newton was a really strange fellow. He's studying optics. Now, did he really start sticking stuff in his eye, you know, to do these experiments? He did.
He took what they called a bodkin, you know, a little sort of a, something like a small belaying pin, and stuck it up behind the eyeball, between the bone and the eyeball, and used to probe around trying to figure out the anatomy of the eye. Lucky he didn't blind himself.
Really? He's called the last of the magicians.
You know, Newton was so far beyond anyone else in the world that he was working in a landscape in which there were no boundary lines and no rules, and he simply went wherever his interest took him. He studied alchemy for many years, and probably poisoned himself in the process through mercury poisoning. He devoted tremendous effort to studying biblical scriptures and learning Aramaic and so forth in order to interpret the scriptures better. Hundreds of pages of Newton's papers are devoted to subjects that we today would find to be sterile and pointless as compared to his scientific work. But the thing is that he didn't know that. He had no way of knowing it. He was completely on the frontier in all of these fields, and he was all by himself. He created a whole world in his mind, and everywhere he went, it was unexplored territory. It was Lewis and Clark every day of his working life.
Amazing. My guest is Timothy Ferris. His book is called Coming of Age in the Milky Way. Isaac Newton deliberately left stuff out of his papers and you know, would be rather obscure in what he was writing. You interviewed a lot of scientists for your book. Did you find them to be forthcoming about what they were working on and what their conclusions might be?
You know, I always have. I've been writing about science now for, I guess, 15 years or so, and it has always amazed me, the willingness of scientists to, by and large, to drop whatever they are doing and devote their efforts to trying to explain to you as clearly as they possibly can exactly what it is they're doing, and with the most passionate excitement in many cases. It's just the opposite of what you find, say, in a, you know, if you go to a NATO military installation in Europe, people tend to be a bit hedged, and they're trying to keep you from finding out what's going on because they're worried about security. If you go to a place like CERN, the big particle accelerator where hundreds of scientists work in Switzerland, it's just the opposite. It's like a white hole of information. You can walk down the hall, total stranger, and stick your head in and say, "You know, I'm interested in this, and I understand you're doing something about it." And almost without exception, people will say, "Oh, well, here, let me show you." They're just, their whole community, you know, is geared to conveying information to each other because they have to do that to work. It's an open, unclassified, and open-ended intellectual adventure. And that's one reason that I think the scientific community is a good model for what other human communities could be like if we were just a bit more sensible about particularly international affairs.
In the ancient days, the movements of the stars and so forth informed their lives in a very tangible way. When a certain star appeared, you'd know that this plant was ready for picking and that sort of thing. With the wealth of theories and discoveries that are going on every day, partially because of the technology that's available to us, computers can think very fast and, you know, the men are still thinking. How much of these theories and discoveries are informing our lives every day?
Not very much yet, because it takes a while for them to sink in. Alfred North Whitehead used to say that it takes a great idea 1,000 years to be fully assimilated into human culture. I think that one of the most important realizations in the recent history of science is that the universe has had an origin in history, and that it's possible to investigate that origin back to very early times, to a fraction of a second after the beginning of time, through existing physics and near-future particle physics. But this is an enormous idea with tremendous implications that even those in the field can only begin to appreciate. And it's going to take a while before the average person who's not able to devote so much time to science can begin also to think about what these things do to his or her view of themselves and of the wider universe. But I can tell you that the potential is tremendous. It's a completely different way of looking at the world and at our place in it, and it will have an impact on ethics and as well as on the intellect that, as I say, we're only beginning to be able to glimpse.
Very briefly, the very last words in your book are, "For all my pains, I only beg this favor, that whenever you see the sun, the heavens, or the stars, you will think of me." Do you hope when we go out at night now and look at the stars, we're going to think of you?
No, that was a man named Bernard de Fontenille, who was a wonderful science fiction writer. Mm-hmm. And I would urge anyone I don't need to urge anyone, but I certainly hope that anyone going out to look at the stars would think about the stars and about almost anything else before they thought about me. That would be a terrible effect for a book to have.
Timothy Ferris, thank you very, very much for enlightening us into our place in the universe.
Thanks, been a pleasure.
Timothy Ferris's new book is Coming of Age in the Milky Way. It's published by William Morrow. Ferris teaches astronomy and science writing at the University of California in Berkeley. I'm Leanne Hansen, and this is Fresh Air.